Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Trauma Super Conference. My name is Jaya Bristow, and I'm one of your hosts. And today I am so thrilled to be welcoming the wonderful Meg John Barker. Welcome, Meg John.
Hi, great to be here.
Great to have you. So today we're going to be talking all about relational trauma. Now, this is a juicy topic, and I'm excited to see what comes up. Do you want to start by telling us a bit about why you feel this is important territory for you and maybe in general as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so been brought home for me in recent years. Like, I guess it feels like so much sort of out there is about the kind of foundation, all of the kind of structures and systems kind of crumbling and being laid bare, and seeing just how sort of shaky the foundations were of sort of everything, how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to each other, how we relate in communities, and how we relate to land and the world. It feels like all of that has sort of come crashing down, and sort of, again, this sort of sense of out there, but also in here for me personally, because a lot of kind of relationships have had that sort of falling apart in my life in the last few years, just before and just after the pandemic, which has left me really like searching for answers about, yeah, seeing, I guess, my ways of relating really revealed to me kind of painfully, how I relate to myself and others. Also seeing how I respond when other people are relating from a place of trauma, and really questioning, like, how can I do that better? Seeing kind of relationship trauma showing up a lot in community as well, and lots of painful kind of rifts and ruptures that don't get repaired. And so it feels like this urgent set of questions, and it feels very interrelated at all those levels for me. So I've just been, yeah, really like looking into relational trauma, like, where does it come from? What can we do about it? How can we relate differently? Who's exploring that territory? It feels like, you know, the urgent question of our times in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you've written a lot of books around relationships and different ways of relating, and like your most famous book, Rewriting the Rules, and which is also the name of your blog, and, you know, is all about, you know, finding the right relationship for you. It's not about a bit like applying a set of rules, and it's not about whether you're monogamous or non-monogamous or straight or not straight or anything like that, right? It's about really questioning for yourself. And that's wonderful. But as you say, you know, when we have trauma, and trauma is ingrained in so many different relationships, and, you know, we hosted, as with Conscious Life, we've hosted a whole relationship super conference, and there is so much material there, and you were a guest on it, and it's fantastic. But and we really see relationships, it's such a big word, like, it, there's so much relating. And I love that you include relating to ourselves, because that is, for all of us, I think, our primary relationship. And when we have trauma, that our relationship with ourselves is going to then impact our relationships with everyone else, whether it's with family or lovers or friends or groups or individuals or small groups or work, or, you know. And I've spoken on this conference about like trauma in the workplace. I've spoken about, you know, we talk about family trauma, we talk about all these things, and they're all covered by relationships. So I think this is a great place to begin exploring this territory. How do you understand cultural and developmental trauma, and how those combine to produce or reproduce relational trauma?
Yeah, and this is something I'm so drawing on my co-author Alex Iantaffe, who wrote this book Gender Trauma, and I think that was my starting point for learning about this, but I've been like reading everything I can on these topics ever since. I guess in terms of, yeah, developmental, I feel like between them, developmental trauma and cultural trauma form this kind of relational trauma that we then experience. And, you know, that however much, you know, I've been looking for the right person or the right way of doing relationships, the right kind of style or something, this kind of traumatized and traumatizing way of relating still comes in, to the point where I guess, you know, what I'm seeing now is I have to address that. You know, I'm not going to find a relationship that doesn't have that in with that particular person or particular community. I'm not going to find a way of doing relationships like monogamy or polyamory that gets rid of this. It's like, it's relational trauma, and it comes from the developmental trauma piece and the cultural trauma piece, and that they're interrelated.
Do you want to Let's just, because some people might be new to all of this, so let's just talk, define maybe a bit more what is cultural trauma and what is developmental trauma, and then we'll go into how they impact relational trauma.
Well, yeah, I think I might say, like, you know, these different elements of developmental trauma and how each of them does sort of play out later on, right? Because I feel like one piece is this idea that it's not so much about the what happens to you as a kid, like tough stuff is going to happen as you grow up, but it's about this question of, is it held and heard by anyone, right? And a lot of this research is finding that, you know, even if people go through really tough stuff when they're growing up, if it's held and heard by the people around them, you know, their community, their family, then they can do all right. But if it's not, we're left with these unbearable feelings. So if we have kind of really difficult emotions that, you know, are kind of dismissed, or they're blamed on us, or we're punished even for having them, you know, and again, it may not be in explicitly kind of abusive or violent ways, but not being held and heard means that, you know, we're left with all these feelings and generally find ways to kind of push them down. But then when they come up as adults, and they tend to be triggered again by relational dynamics that echo the things that we experienced in the past. So that is one way that we're likely to sort of bring our early trauma into later relationships. We're also quite likely to look for what we lacked or lost as kids in our, you know, later relationships, and not be aware that we're doing that, these sort of unconscious patterns, which means we might well just replicate the same kind of traumatized dynamics, or sometimes we find ourselves even acting out the other side of the trauma, and, you know, causing that sort of trauma response in other people and harming other people from that. So that's the sort of emotion piece. Then, you know, the research on kind of shame and trauma suggests that, you know, when we're brought up in these kind of ways, we tend to assume there must be something wrong with us. You know, if we're not getting held or heard, you know, or if people out around us are saying there's something wrong with us, or just simply not being safe enough for us, then we tend to assume there's something wrong with us. Because as kids, it'd be way more dangerous to realize that the people we rely on aren't safe enough than it is to think there's something wrong with us. And the idea that something wrong with us gives us at least some sense that we might be able to do something about it and have some kind of control. But that seems to be where the real fundamental sense of, you know, I'm bad, and the, you know, the shame gets in. And then we come up with all these ways to kind of block that shame by, like, avoiding, or by withdrawing, or by attacking out or attacking in. And all those kind of responses get in the way of intimacy. So again, once we're in our later relationships, you know, we might be very avoidant and not sort of go towards intimacy, or we might be trying for, like, this really close intimacy and kind of leaping in, and then, you know, having all kinds of problems because we haven't, you know, really kind of got very, again, very firm foundations for the relationship. And then the last piece I would say about developmental trauma is this piece about rupture and repair. You know, so again, they find with what we could call developmental trauma, and again, it doesn't have to be very obviously abusive childhood experiences, although it can be, is that just ruptures are left unrepaired. So, you know, kind of conflicts or tough times, or times when a parent, you know, does blame a kid or can't hold them very well, there isn't that attempt to repair it, so they're left unresolved. And again, that really lingers in the body, you know, and it's really easy to kind of re-trigger. And again, it tends to be in our more intimate relationships and relationships of all kind. I wouldn't say it's just, you know, romantic relationships, but close relationships as an adult and relationships with community colleagues that will re-trigger those kind of things. And again, the real danger is that we're caught in these kind of relational dynamics that just perpetuate, you know, and we don't get the chance to be held and heard as an adult, or to learn how to do rupture and repair. You know, we simply don't have any sense of how do you do rupture and repair because we haven't learned how to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so important that you're bringing in all these different elements, because, you know, so often I think more and more people understand now that trauma isn't just these big, huge, scary things that happen, right? That trauma can be caused by all kinds of things, and that it's much more to do with a holding environment of whether we feel safe and secure, whether our nervous system has been re-regulated after it's been, you know, jarred by an event or a thing, and that there's physical and emotional trauma, which, you know, caused by physical and emotional hurts often, but that, again, it's the holding environment which either causes or perpetuates the trauma as well, which I think we'll get into later on about perpetuating or healing trauma. And so often, you know, people can be like, but I don't know what's wrong with me that I have all these difficult relationships, that I'm bad at relationships when I have a perfectly decent family. My parents, you know, are still together, love each other. I've not had any big trauma. Like, what's wrong with me? And so then it adds this kind of like layer of like, there's something wrong, there's something bad, rather than, you know, what you're talking about is just understanding and seeing how this trauma is created and developed and played out and then perpetuated.
And I think we all do, again, in our, you know, this is where the cultural piece relates to the developmental, because I think in the dominant cultures that we're brought up in, you know, these things are, it's the intergenerational piece for start, that these things aren't healed at any point along the way, you know, and heals a difficult world, but, you know, they're not addressed at any point along the way. So our parents will just likely bring us up in a similar ways, the way they were brought up, you know. And again, it's, it doesn't need to be explicitly abusive things for parents just not to be okay with their own emotions, not to model self-care, not to know how to repair ruptures, you know. And it's, if there's that shame in the parent, you know, it's really hard for them to go to a child and say, I'm really sorry I didn't do that right, you know, which would be the way to kind of repair the rupture. So the child's just left with rupture after rupture and blaming themselves because that's all they've got, right? And, you know, I think there's so little support, you know, for parents to learn how to do this stuff, and actually so much encouragement for them to parent in ways that, you know, are traumatizing. You know, if a parent, you know, themselves, you know, didn't get, you know, had this kind of developmental trauma as a child, they're likely to then look to their own kids to give them what they lacked and lost. You know, often if they haven't got that from partners or from other people in their life, you know, again, unconsciously, their hope in a child, you know, will be able to kind of make it right. And then they play all this stuff with the child, and then the child goes on to, you know, and we know this now, but there's still very little support for like learning how to do it differently. There's still explicit parenting advice that says, you know, leave your child alone when they're upset, you know, rather than going to them. You know, it's really still the kind of thing that was there in the parenting I received. And also then the other way the culture kind of is part of it is, you know, our really stretched kind of stressful lives under capitalism that mean, you know, that even if parents really knew how to do all of this stuff, they don't have the time or the space to do it. They're so stretched themselves, they're likely to behave in, you know, ways that repress feelings or react out of feelings, rather than, you know, having the slowness and the space that we actually need to be able to hold and hear people, to be able to do rupture and repair. So I think, you know, just under capitalism as it is at the moment, and under the kind of crises that everyone's facing, makes it even more likely that these things just keep getting passed on.
Absolutely. And I think it's so important, you know, all these different elements that you bring in, the intergenerational piece, you know, that once, you know, we if we have trauma and we haven't worked on our own trauma and we have kids, of course we're going to pass it on. It's kind of natural. Yeah. And then, as you say, when you bring in the layers of like parenting books, which literally give advice on basically how to traumatize your child. Yes. And, you know, it's not what they're doing. And there's all these different methods, but like that people do, and they really, you know, someone can be very willing to do the right thing, but you get all this conflicting advice. Yeah. It can be so confusing, and you do what you think is best. And so again, I want people who are listening to know this is not a criticism of any parenting style or anything. And I think we're going to get into this bit in a bit as well, of just how hard it is, all this stuff. But that it's really important to understand the intergenerational piece. And I talk a lot about sort of ancestral trauma healing with Jonathan Meenag in a different interview, which I recommend people check out.
Because it goes back generations. Seeing in mind, it's not just, you know, and again, caregivers, parents, it's not just the generation before, but it's often the one before that and what they're all carrying in, you know. So we're still really impacted by, things generations back in our family, of, you know, how the culture was back then, you know, stiff upper lip or dealing with the, you know, the war or whatever. It's like that's still there, isn't it? And it's playing out in us if it hasn't been kind of addressed along the way.
100%. And even when we start the, you know, so I think trauma can be perpetuated and take on more through generations. And even when you start the trauma healing, I think it can take multiple generations because there's a lot of stuff, you know. And I think it's really interesting you talk about the culture, especially the capitalist culture in today's society. I'm at the age now where like my friends are popping out babies left, right, and center. Right? And it's really interesting. What I really notice is that, you know, previous generations, there was a very often very gender based way, but there was a parent that went and worked and a parent that stayed at home with the child. Now there is the expectation that both parents do it all, you know, and that's if the child has two parents. Again, I don't want to, I know that, as you say, there's lots of different caregiving situations and family structures, and sometimes there's more parents, sometimes there's less parents, sometimes there's grandparents, sometimes there's, you know, there's all kinds of different things. And but I really see how there is that expectation of you keep a full-time job and you become a great parent and you have a social life and you, you know, make lots of money and you buy a new house. And and it's just, it's literally impossible. So then the caregivers, I'm going to call them, have all this stress. And then that stress adds to activates their own trauma and means that they can just be less present with their children, which adds all these extra layers.
Yeah, completely. And I do think, you know, thinking about that normative ideal, you know, the kind of hetero patriarchal kind of norm of this atomized couple who's doing it all, you know, the move away from communities, the move away from extended family models. It's too, you know, it's far too much. It's far too much, you know, on and you're sort of stuck in, you know, both the romantic couple and the kind of nuclear family is very stuck in together in this kind of private sphere where you're not supposed to show any failings or any problems, you know, and there's not much support, you know, often very isolated, often moving around for work, you know, very difficult to form supportive networks. So yeah, I think all of that kind of modern mode is part of the problem, and there isn't much out there sort of saying this is what we're up against, you know, and this might be really part of this huge burden people are facing. And it's much more like, here's this ideal that you're supposed to live up to, and you must pretend that you're living up to it at all times, and, you know, not admit how incredibly hard it is.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting you're talking about this moving away from community, and I'd love to get into that a bit more as well. And there's something comes to mind around that word community, because whether we have chosen community or not, we're never bringing children up in a tiny microcosm either, right? Like the children is going to be exposed, whether it's through schooling or friends or aunties and uncles or caregivers friends or peers, you know, whoever there is, or these days with internet and TV and, you know, we're constantly exposed to so many messages. So however fantastic the primary caregivers are, there is all this stuff going on. And as you say, it's really hard. So let's talk some more about both, you know, we started talking about how our current dominant culture sort of traumatizes relationships and encourages traumatizing relationships. I don't know if you have any more you want to add about that. And I'm curious to see what kinds of what other relationship models there are, how we can step away from that and into something that's more supportive, not just for the children, right, but for us as adults as well. Because most of the people listening to this, okay, maybe the way they raise their kids is one thing, but they're no longer kids, right? They've already dealt with all the trauma, they've got all the trauma. So what do we do now?
Absolutely. And I would definitely say as well, when I'm planning to write about this with Alex soon, we're going to do a book called How to Understand Your Relationships. And I always defer to Alex on the parenting piece because they've done it and I haven't. And I'm very aware of, like, you know, it's all very well to say, you know, how damaging that kind of developmental trauma can be. But as you say, it's not about laying blame. It's about recognizing the intergenerational model of it. And I suppose, I'm more like focused on relationships between adults, and I've been for many years focused on, you know, romantic relationships particularly, and the pressures that are brought to bear there. And I suppose that going back to your first question of like, how does this dominant culture like show up in our romantic relationships, I think you know, if we're talking about sort of capitalist, colonialist, like white supremacist, heteropatriarchal culture, all of these kind of oppressive systems and structures that we're in, that, you know, we can't step outside of culture. All those things are going to show up in the way we relate. So, you know, just going through those words, I was thinking, yeah, we have, you know, the normative kind of ideals of relationship have this kind of capitalism built in, that almost like other people are property, you know, that we want to get them. We want to get them, or we want to get their love, or, you know, this is a really familiar kind of model. You know, there isn't any, you know, challenged enough that, you know, you fall in love with somebody and then you've got to get them and you've got to keep them. And they sort of belong to, you know, we use words like you belong to me. And, you know, it's really like treating people as property. And people like bell hooks and Eric Fromm have written about this over the years, this kind of idea of having somebody else rather than being with them. And that, you know, almost you could say a lot of us don't really know love, another kind of love, you know, the kind of love that bell hooks really points to, where we value ourselves and others, and, you know, where there isn't that kind of, where we know that we're all interconnected. It's like we're just so used to this kind of mentality of like, I want them, I want to get them, you know, I want to get these feelings, I don't want those feelings, you know. It's very, it is a very capitalist model. And then also kind of, I was thinking colonialist as well, you know, this sort of idea that we can and should like shape people into being something for us, that we almost need to colonize their lives and their feelings, you know, that we need to make them feel certain things, and that we're sort of betrayed if they don't feel towards us how we want them to feel, or they don't want to live the life that we want to live with them. You know, that real sense.
Fascinating.
That
yeah, I've never thought about that way, but that whole emphasis of on fixing someone, you know, whether, and especially if we're looking at the heteronormative model, for example, there's often like the women will take on like broken men and fix them, for example, you know, not to go into super stereotypical territory here, but.
Romantic, isn't it, to want to fix, you know, or, you know, yeah, that romantic ideal of kind of Beauty and the Beast, or the the Pygmalion, you know, the kind of idea of the, that's more the sort of the man, you know, making the woman into what he wants,
exactly, into the ideal yummy object. You know, in some of the work I do, we talk about sort of object relations and the way we project onto other people, and one is like the yummy object. It's like that idealized, that desire. And, you know, there's, and again, all this is reinforced by all the messaging in society, from, you know, Disney to rom-coms. And I think there is a huge shift that is happening now. And I really want to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
there's still the main messages is this idea of find the one and live happily ever after. And the one has to be, you know, you have your checklist of what that person's meant to be like. And then if when they don't meet that, you fix them into becoming the right person. So
do it in such, such like insidious ways as well. It's like, that seems like, oh, I wouldn't do that. But unconsciously, it's like these, you know, we just can't kind of bear it often when we get very invested in, you know, partners, or maybe sometimes friends, colleagues, and then it becomes quite unbearable if their, you know, their difference to us becomes unbearable, or their tough feelings become unbearable. And it's like, it's when we can't be alongside them, we have to try and downplay what they're feeling, or deny it, or, you know, that feels like we're sort of colonizing in a way their feel, you know, when your partner says they're upset about something and you just can't sit alongside it, you have to try and fix it, or try and tell them it's not really that big of a deal, or, you know, it's like those little strands really come into our relating all the time. I would say it's almost like a real effort to not do it, and to, you know, to be really be alongside somebody as that they are, and not try and fix them into something for us. Yeah.
And often the fixing comes from a place of love, right? Like when someone's going, I have a caregiver who does that a lot with me, right? Where I'm like, I just want to express my feelings, and they're looking for a magical fix for me to help me feel better. And it comes from a place of love.
Yeah.
I actually need in that moment is for just my feelings to be held and met. And I see how, you know, how through the trauma lens, what you're describing, how traumatizing it is, because we see that trauma is created when the holding environment isn't there, and when our feelings are dismissed or belittled, or we're told to feel something different. All these things is how trauma is created, especially in early trauma, you know, in childhood and stuff. And so then we're in a relationship, and there's suddenly it seems so innocuous and innocent, that kind of wanting, because the aim behind that is just, I want my partner to feel better. So it's like, oh, it's not that big a deal. Oh no, yeah. You're fine. Oh, just cheer up. Oh, look, let's do something different. What will cheer you up right now? Or, you know, or things like that, but it's not holding space for the person. And so it reactivates that small part of them, that child, that traumatized part. And suddenly I'm like seeing all the patterns of how easy and how often and how obvious it is that we're constantly relating from a places of trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, and the ways also that the things that we didn't get in childhood, we're really looking for in the other, we might project that onto them at the beginning and assume they're all those things, you know, but it's so much our projection. And then we feel let down and abandoned when they're not that thing. Or, you know, projecting onto the other the things that we don't like in ourselves and then attacking them in the other is, you know, really common way of relating.
And in today's world with like modern technology, the opportunity for projection is enhanced because so often people meet online and you're texting, so you don't even have a person there. And so the projections are enhanced even more. And then we all naturally project anyway, right? Even when you do have someone there. But yeah, fascinating. Yeah. Tell me more, Meg John. Tell me more.
Well, I was thinking about what I've been reading, you know, recently from sort of Black feminism about white supremacy and the kind of sense of perfectionism in that, and how it's unacceptable to kind of admit failings and flaws, and how that plays out in relationships. You know, again, there's this real idea that it's not okay to show that you're struggling. And I think then relationships become very insular. You know, again, the kind of extreme on all of these is really abusive and coercive, and the relationships dynamics, which are incredibly common. But even in ones that don't kind of go to that extreme, this sort of idea that you have to present this Instagram relationship, right? You know, that's all lovely, and that you just mustn't, you know, there's no transparency, there's this sense of privacy, you know, and people in your community and your friends feeling like, oh, I mustn't say if I think it's a bit off or something, because, you know, you've got to kind of, yeah, you're not really supposed to intrude in that private sphere of the relationship. And then, you know, another thing I was reading, you know, along similar lines, was about this, again, in kind of dominant culture, this sort of criminal justice system idea that to cause harm to another person means you are bad, you know, not that you've done bad, but that you are bad. And I think that's so entrenched in our culture at the moment, which makes it almost impossible to do rupture and repair, because that involves being able to say that you have caused harm. And it feels like this is really big at the moment, the sense that, you know, nobody can, you're kind of encouraged to be sort of accountable and responsible, but it's almost impossible if we buy into this dominant culture idea that doing something, causing some harm, means that we're a bad person, because who could possibly admit, you know, and also that we've got all that developmental trauma and all that shame where we're scared stiff that someone's going to think that we are a bad person. Mm-hmm. And we've also got this kind of model that says, if you harm anybody, and of course we're always going to be wounding each other and being wounded.
Of course.
So, you know,
it's massively enhanced by cancel culture, right? So we see that today, which really enhances the idea that if you do something wrong, you are bad, and you don't deserve any more rights, you don't deserve to exist, you don't deserve to have a say, you don't deserve to defend yourself, you are bad. And of course, that kind of divisive rhetoric, and that kind of, rather than that learning to take responsibility and learning to apologize, like, that would be such a better culture, right? Like, supporting people in, oh, you've caused harm, how do you take responsibility, apologize, and repair for that harm? But instead, it's just, you're bad, the end.
Yeah, and exactly. And then, you know, if you look at any of the kind of therapeutic stuff around trauma, it's like, we need to learn how to do rupture and repair. But, you know, that kind of way of relating, whether it's in communities and social media or in our close relating, it doesn't, you know, it's far too scary. Rupture is far too scary. We're not going to experience rupture and repair. So therefore we're left, you know, flailing. No, rupture is likely to just lead to, you know, completely break up or break down or, you know, cancelling, rather than this sort of potential for repair, you know, transformation, healing, whatever we want to call it. So it's sort of showing how all of those aspects of culture, you know, keep the traumatized ways of relating in place and make it really difficult to access support around them. And then I guess the heteropatriarchy bit is like, there's these real norms of like, what does a successful relationship look like? And what's the script for it? And ticking these boxes at certain times, you know, and going from dating to moving in to, you know, relationship commitment to, you know, having kids, whatever. All that kind of, you know, escalator model, as Amy Garan has talked about it. You know, there's this default script for success for a relationship. And again, then it makes it very hard to do anything else. And it does polarize into, you know, either we stay together or if we fail at any of these levels, mm-hmm. we must break up, rather than a sense of like relationships could go in different directions. They might get closer over time. They might get less close, you know, that we could keep an eye on that process of relating, rather than having, you know, the fixed thing of a relationship. And, you know, it could be this dynamic, ever-changing thing that we're able to check in about, and how's it going now, and, you know, sort of ebb and flow in it. You know, that's so hard in this kind of fixed script model of relating.
I love that. I mean, I don't love the heteropatriarchal model, but I love everything you've just shared. Because I think when I first heard you say, you know, our dominant culture, capitalist, colonialist, white supremacist, heteropatriarchal, you know, all this impacts our relationships, I was like, oh God, here we go. Where is this going, right? I can imagine so many people just switching off, because those words themselves can activate a lot of trauma in people. Hearing about how it's not really about those words. It's not even really about that. It's just noticing that there are elements in our culture that are so embedded. And you know, I work a lot with this. I lead workshops on power, privilege, and prejudice, where I look exactly at this, but that are so embedded that they impact every aspect of our life. And they're invisible.
Yes.
You know, they're not like,
so powerful. Hey,
this is
completely invisible. Yes.
So it's very difficult. And so to see, like, there's so many things, despite the fact that I've been doing this work for a long time now, there's so many things you've just illustrated, and the way that you can assign each thing to the culture, to, oh, this is because of capitalism culture, capitalist culture, this is because, or, you know, and again, whatever words people use to understand, oh yeah, that is the culture and the messaging that we receive as individuals. It impacts the way we raise our kids, and therefore the way, you know, impacts the way we were raised, and therefore the way we raise our kids. It impacts our relationships with our loved ones, impacts our relationships with ourselves. And it's so important to bring light to this. So I'm so grateful for this conversation we're having today and the way that you illustrate all of this. And it brings an extra lens of understanding, I think, to a lot of the work people are already doing around, you know, whether around these topics or around trauma in general, especially like relational trauma. So it's fascinating. So yeah, the next question is like, what do we do to counter all of this? What models exist out there? What are some ways that we can start being kinder to ourselves and to those around us, you know, working, doing more repair than canceling, doing more. Because, you know, I've just had a chat with someone else where we talked about understanding the patterns is the first step. But once you understand them, what do you do with it? Once we see this is the way we're impacted, what now?
Yeah, it's a really tough question. And again, I suppose, I'm almost wary of, you know, anyone setting up any kind of relationship style as having the answers to this. You know, I think we're all kind of flawed and fumbling our way along, you know, and I guess it's about, you know, part of it is just seeing the extent of what we're up against in terms of like that developmental trauma that's like lingering on in our body minds, you know, and is, you know, operating through us all the time, you know, as long as we're not conscious of it. And like you say, even once we're conscious of it, that's basically us watching it happen over and over again. It doesn't go from like conscious of it to completely not doing it anymore.
If only, that would make
life
so
much easier. Maybe a lifelong period in between. And then, you know, realizing what we're up against in terms of wider culture and how it's operating through us, and kind of trying to alleviate some of the shame around that, that when you see that kind of operating through you and you hear those words come out of your mouth or you observe those actions, it's like knowing like how hard it would be to just to somehow step outside of that or do it differently. So, you know, my history is I have been really interested in relationship diversity, and I think you might link to the zine I've done on this, like there are diverse ways of doing relationships where people have tried to address some of this. But again, I wouldn't want to say like these non-normative ways of doing relationships are somehow superior to normative ways. I think we're all up against this, whether we're single, you know, whether we're in a normative kind of couple relationship, whether we've moved outside that or tried polyamory or something like that. You know, however much we've kind of tried different models, they all struggle with this stuff. Again, it's gonna play out whether we like it or not. But I think it is worth, you know, reading some of the things that have been written from some of these alternative perspectives, of, you know, people trying polyamory as a way of getting away from this ownership of one person kind of model, and you know, the scarcity kind of model of love that says that you can only love one person at a time, you know, really challenging that idea and seeing love as much more kind of a flowing thing, you know, and yeah, attempting often to build different kinds of networks of love. But again, polyamory, as I've written about a few times, it can easily fall into traps of kind of hierarchies of romantic love still being a hierarchical, you know, over kind of friendship love and other kinds of love. And sometimes, again, people being like primary relationships being treated in some ways as superior to other kinds of relationships as well. I was really interested. Victoria Brooks has written this book called Mistress Ethics. And she's saying, you know, saying a lot of things, but it really questions the idea of, you know, kind of consensual non-monogamy as this really superior way of relating, as it sometimes is presented as being, and saying, well, you know, mistresses, you know, people who are kind of having affairs are really challenging. You know, there's something, you know, really ethical about this position of, you know, recognizing that that person loves you and loves somebody else, and kind of, yeah, like, yeah, it's like a moving away from ownership. You know, she's kind of arguing that's a moving away from a sense that you could own somebody, and really accepting that you don't, that even kind of polyamory and other consensual non-monogamous still seem to sometimes bring in this idea that you own these people in some ways. And then there's relationship anarchy, you know, which is a bit more explicitly political and really believes in kind of radical freedom and not hierarchizing different forms of relationship, really trying to get away from this idea of ownership. I think I get a lot out of the asexual and aromantic communities as well, that really question the central role of sex and romance in relationships. And again, like challenging these hierarchies, you know, and also these ideas that our partners owe us, you know, sex, or owe us feeling a certain way about us, you know, really like, yeah, troubling that sense that there's this sort of owe an obligation and duty kind of in relationships to perform certain kinds of emotional or erotic kind of labor. So I guess, you know, yeah, thinking about relationship diversity and really trying to question the idea that any style of relating is kind of better than any other. Certainly practitioners watching this, I would want to, you know, really affirm, in just as you could affirm multiple sexualities and multiple genders, also affirming like multiple relationship styles is equally valid, and seeing everybody on a journey or a path to finding the ways of relating that fit them better, rather than a sense of any being like right or wrong.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes. Everything you just said. Yes. Like, I think what I most love about what you said is that, again, it's not about the model you choose. It's not about there is one correct way of doing relationships and one incorrect way. It's about, you know, it's not just even about finding what works for you. It's about learning from the different ways. It's about there are a multitude of ways of relating. There's already, you know, if we're taking conventional relationships, right? Yeah. There's friendships, there's family relationships, there's lovers, there's committed loving relationship, committed yes. romantic relationships, which are different to like casual lovers, which is different exactly. to friendship, which is different to family, which is different to, you know, and even within French, and which is different to like your colleagues or your co-workers, which is different, you know, we have all these different ways of relating to people, which yeah. impact the ways that we show up in those relationships, which impact mm. what we expect of ourselves and the other person, which impact, you know, all these things. And then when we take in all the unconventional, all the ways of relating, all the relationship models and formats that go against the mainstream. And what's mm. fantastic with that, it's not saying, oh, non-monogamy is the way forward and everyone should yeah. do non-monogamy. It's like, what can you learn about polyamory, about relationship anarchy? Read the yeah. books, not to do the things, but to yeah. see what people have found. Because when you go against the norm, you automatically yeah. end up being confronted and seeing all these things we were talking about earlier, the way that we're influenced mm. by dominant culture, because as soon as you step away from dominant culture, it's just in your face, right?
Yeah.
And I see how like people do polyamory but still apply some of the same rules
exactly.
that they were doing it in like traditional monogamy. And then there's, I was just thinking about this last night, about how I see sometimes as like active monogamy and passive monogamy. So what mm. I mean by that is, for example, people who haven't questioned any of this and they're just going along because it's what's expected of them. It's what they expect of themselves. It's the messaging is they get from society. They're not thinking about it. And then mm. there are people like one of my absolute best friends. She mm. is 100% monogamous, right?
Yeah.
And, but she's actively monogamous. And what I mean by that is she's read all the books. She's mm. friends with me. So she hears about yes, all these yes. conversations I have, right? She lived yeah. with me when I discovered polyamory the first time and started exploring all of that. She, you know, and then, and she questioned all the things and she realized that she is monogamous, but there are still, she's not just going along with it blindly, yeah. you know, she's not just doing it because it's expected. And she's questioned and noticed the ways that she did like have hierarchies, is that a word? Hierarchies, have hierarchies yeah. in her relationships around romantic and friendship. And that, that's something she doesn't want to do anymore. She mm. notices like what needs want to be met in what relationship. She, and so I think it's wonderful what you're saying is not for anyone listening of like monogamy is bad, it's not, or yeah. non-monogamy is bad, or polyamory is better or less good than yeah. or the different ways of doing non-monogamy, or be a mistress or don't be a mistress,
yeah, exactly.
or, you know, it's not about any of that. It's about, if we don't recognize the fact that we are being influenced by all this conditioning through mm. our culture, through our, you know, intergenerational like inheritance, through yeah. our early development trauma, through all of that. If we don't recognize that, then we are just going to continue playing out
yeah.
the patterns that are embedded in us. And I'm sure everyone who is listening can recognize that they have certain relationship patterns, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's, and a lot of those patterns are trauma informed.
Yeah.
And so it's like, but we have a choice. We have a choice as individuals to open our eyes to that, to recognize that, and to do the work, which can be extremely painful and uncomfortable mm. and isn't easy, to first of all, become aware. And I think this conversation has hopefully helped people become aware of some things at least, and there's a long yeah. way to go
yeah.
and then start interrupting those patterns, do the yeah. work to start healing your own trauma. And in doing so, I often talk about the ripple effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
That by doing it, sometimes we feel like, oh my God, it's so overwhelming, where do we begin? We begin right here, right now, with ourselves. And in so doing, we have a ripple effect. You've been doing all this work, which you're now sharing with me, which is going to impact me. And then I'm going to have this conversation with someone and it will impact someone else. And luckily for us, this conversation is being listened to by hundreds, maybe thousands, maybe tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people. And so if each of those people are also inspired by something and start making a shift, start yeah. interrupting one of their patterns, then slowly we have this ripple mm. effect where we start modeling the behaviors and the ways of relating that we want, of the society that we want to live in, the relationships we want to experience. And then we start attracting other people who are doing the same. And then we start feeding each from each other and teaching each other. And it becomes this beautiful dance where we can learn from each other rather than cancelling each other.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I think you're right. I love a friend of mine, Anita Cassidy, writes on the Aletheia website about conscious monogamy and conscious commitment. So it's about moving from the what kind of relationship style you have or who do you have it with, to this question of how do we relate, and how do we relate in a way that's more conscious, slower, more consensual, you know, and very trauma sensitive, you know, really aware of our trauma patterns and other people's, really aware of our limits, you know, where we can go and where we can't. Yeah, and really slow down and to notice these things in ourselves and where we can to be open about, you know, this is my stuff and this is what I bring. And also this is how I'm working on it. But it is a long, slow, yeah, maybe lifelong process given all we're up against, you know. And it is excruciating to kind of see, you know, when you slow down and notice, you just see how much of it is playing out. Like, again, as we said at the beginning, in your relationship with yourself, in your relationship with others, even when you're just imagining them in your head and having imaginary conversations with them, right? You know,
I do that a lot.
In our communities, you know, just how much expectation and hope we bring to these things, and then how much that, you know, that those early patterns play out yet again. So, you know, the more we can, yeah, slow down and notice it and name it, you know, to ourselves and others. And I suppose I'm always with, we, you know, we need, it got into us in these multiple ways, like, you know, through like the existential layer that I would call it, that, you know, that just human relating is really hard and we tend to treat each other as objects. You know, that's what the existentialists and the Buddhists kind of say. We, you know, we tend to see ourselves as disconnected when actually we're connected. Then the cultural layer that we've talked about, then the developmental relational kind of layer, and then the embodied layer, you know, like that's how it gets, we're in the middle and it gets into us through all those layers. So we need kind of all those layers to find other ways, you know. So there is the solo kind of, you know, doing the meditation practices, slowing down and noticing ourselves, you know, just, you know, being with all those feelings that we didn't used to be able to be with, learning how to do that, learning how to ground ourselves and regulate our own nervous systems. Then it's the relational piece, that we can't learn how to relate in better ways unless we have relationships. And the more we can cultivate, you know, relationships where we can practice rupture and repair, and we can, you know, co-regulate. And, you know, for a lot of people, therapy is, you know, one of the first relationships in which you can practice these and kind of things in a safe enough environment. But also, you know, support groups and other places where people are intentionally doing this work, you know. And then at that community level, you know, can we find microcultures and communities again where people have this shared understanding, you know, whether it's like Buddhist communities where people have that kind of understanding that we need to look at our habitual patterns, or whether it's 12-step, you know, communities where people are doing this kind of work, or whatever it is for you, you know, really helpful if we can cultivate communities of support, you know, where this, you know, this kind of language is there and these kind of practices are encouraged, rather than, you know, just kind of, you know, keep on the search for finding the perfect partner, or, you know, the kind of mainstream. So I feel like that's, for me, it's about cultivating my own, you know, solo practices and stopping and stepping back from a lot of relating and just doing that work, and then also finding relationships where I can be alongside others who are doing the same thing and who are up for like doing that with me, and then containers of kind of communities and microcultures where at least people get this territory and are all kind of working alongside, you know, on it.
It's wonderful. I love that. And I think it's a really great place to inspire people to continue watching more videos, because, yeah, you know, what I mean by that is, like you say, when we see it's a motivation, right? It's a motivation for these practices, because so often it's like, why should I question all these things? Why should I do all these meditation? Why should it, you know, it's just like, yeah, good for you. Yeah. So what? But here it's like, no, we really see that we are all impacted, and not just us, but our relationships. And therefore that, you know, I talked about the positive ripple effect, but if we're not careful, there's also a lot of negative ripple effect, you know? And I see that I've had this conversation with people in my life recently where it's like that toxic relationship you're in, or that thing that you did, it doesn't just impact you. It doesn't just impact you and me, for example, if it's happened to me. It doesn't, because for example, a partner of mine was in a very toxic relationship with someone else, right? So then that relationship was impacted, would impact my relationship with that person because they'd come to me. And then I was impacted. So then I'd call my best friend up and cry on the phone to her, right? And be like, well, this stuff is happening. Or maybe I wouldn't cry, I'd process whatever. So then her day, that was the first, she'd wake up and have this voice message, for example, from me. And then her day's impacted. And then, you know, it's amazing how quickly these things ripple out. It's what you were saying, we're all interconnected, right? So it's so important to do this work for ourselves and for our entourage and for their entourage, etc.
Multiple entourages. And I think it's this thing about slowing down enough to respond rather than repress or react. You know, this is what I get from Pema Chodron, who I'm really into this, but it's, you know, multiple people have talked about it in different ways. It's like, you know, the traumatized way of being is either to repress all the feeling, you know, and sort of dissociate, and you know, then you're then you're relating with people in a way that often is, you know, traumatized and traumatizing, or reactive into those four or five F's, however many F's we have these days, you know, but immediately into a fight or
flight, freeze,
fawn, freeze, flop, whatever. And it's like, how do we put that pause, you know, however long we need till we can, you know, whatever it is that's come at us, you know, this is one of the biggest pieces of work I do at the moment myself, is like, can I put a big enough pause that I can respond, you know, rather than repressing or reacting? And that might be like responding to that email tomorrow instead of right now, but it might be telling somebody I'm not ready to have this conversation about our rupture, you know, for several weeks, for several months. You know, it's waiting till I know that I'm in a place that I can respond, and also co-creating the conditions in which it's possible to respond, you know, rather than repress or react, you know. So like, you know, a relationship rupture I'm kind of navigating at the moment, you know, we are going back to basics and just, you know, doing sharings with each other quite regularly, just really coming back to like, who am I, who are you, and, you know, rooting, putting those foundations back in place before we address the rupture sort of head on. You know, again, I think there's so much encouragement in relationships either to, again, repress and avoid, you know, in those relationships where you never talk about the conflicts and the ruptures, and that is, you know, a bit the death knell of that relationship, or it's not real intimacy, or go the other way and it's like, you know, we've got to respond, we've got to react to this immediately and make this right, and it's still too raw, you know, it's still too hot, you know, it's again about how do we find this other way, this responsive way, where we acknowledge, hey, this has gone on, how are we going to move forward together in this really careful, caring, like kind, tender way that acknowledges something hard happened, and, you know, co-creates a container where that can be addressed. You know, how can we draw on others for support if that's not possible to do between us? You know, again, these sort of transformative justice and these kind of approaches are moving towards like containers where we do this kind of work, but it's still, you know, we're still really fumbling in the dark for like something different than our old models of just like break up, cancel, you know, withdraw completely from that person. It's incredibly hard. But I think, yeah, like the more we can be having these conversations and between us trying to find new models or existing models from cultures that have more of a sense of like, here's how to find pathways, you know, to repair when rupture happens, whether it's internal or relational.
Absolutely. Yeah, I resonate with so much of what you've just said. And it's especially the part that it's hard. You know, we're not saying that this work is easy, but it's essential. It's essential for our own well-being and for others. And it is doable as well. Like it's hard, but it's doable. And it requires that kind of, one of things, I don't know if we've spoken about this before, but one of things that comes up for me a lot in especially talks around relationship is honesty and kindness together.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly what I was just gonna say. Yes,
exactly.
To say what that means for you, but yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly that. You know, sometimes in communication there's so much focus on honesty that people forget to be kind. There's like radical honesty, and it's like, but radical honesty can be really traumatizing or activate and perpetuate trauma in others. Yeah. Or sometimes people are so focused on being kind and they're so afraid, and I see this pattern so often, so afraid to hurt people that they end up hurting everyone because they like end up keeping things, and then by the time they have a conversation about it, it's all come to a head and it's all boiled over and it's all
exactly, you've never talked about any of it, and then suddenly there
exactly,
it all
is. Exactly. Oh. Or it's and so to have the two together and to keep that in mind, that honesty and kindness can go hand in hand, and using that as the basis for communication in a relationship, as the basis, you know, that's how you can express something in a loving way, is having those two qualities together.
And it starts with ourselves. You know, I think these solo practices that I'm doing at the moment, they're about reaching that place of honesty and kindness with ourselves. And you need a container of kindness. Again, this is Pema, you know, of like, without a container of kindness, you cannot look at yourself that honestly, because you're going to see everything in you. You know, this is my work with plurality. It's really about tuning in and finding all of that within me, finding all the Fs, you know, capacity for all those Fs within me, you know, the oppressor within and the oppressed, the abuser and the abused. You need to be so kind to be able to be that honest with yourself. And we really need everyone to do that work and be that honest with themselves. But it can't come from pushing yourself, you know, outside the window of tolerance into overwhelm, seeing all of this in yourself. It has to come with, you know, it's about befriending all those different parts. It's about befriending all those feelings that we couldn't bear when we were younger, you know, and then, you know, moving into honest and kind relation with others where that's agreed upon, and where we co-create a kind enough container to be able to be honest with each other. And really think like, what would kind, honest relating look like? And really annoyingly, that isn't one answer. You know, it's like, it is about every situation that we encounter, you know, stopping, getting to that responsive place, and then what is kind and honest look like here? And it'll be different from what it looked like the day before. You know, sometimes it does look like walking away. Sometimes it looks like walking towards. Sometimes it looks like, you know, being brave and saying the honest thing. Sometimes it involves recognizing that person would not be able to hear that thing yet and not saying it, you know, or just leaving a pause, waiting till you get the sense that they might be ready. Every time it's different, and that makes it ongoing hard work, but like beautiful, beautiful work. And again, I think hopefully like the more you do it, the more you get a kind of positive feedback of, you know, that kind, honest relating with others, you know, brings people into your life who are also, you know, into that kind of way of relating. And then you have these experiences of rupture and repair, and you have experiences of being alongside people in kind, honest ways. And you start to get a bit of positive feedback for this new way of doing things.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, there's this really difficult phase in the middle that, you know, Pete Walker, who talks about complex trauma, talks about, you know. And it doesn't just go from, as we were saying, like, you know, notice the thing you were doing, and then suddenly you're doing the new thing. There's this really painful bit where you've let go of all your kind of survival strategies that you were doing, and you're left with this kind of void. And it's incredibly painful to be doing something different, you know, because those survival strategies were keeping you, you know, feeling safe. And now you're going out, you know, into this really scary zone of like, yeah, more honest kind of relating with others.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm really glad you brought in the reminder that it starts with oneself, you know, because that's the hardest bit, is being kind and honest with oneself. Like, learning to be kind and honest with other people, it's hard, but it feels more doable than doing it with ourselves. Often we're our own, you know, meanest critic. And you know, I think that, yeah, that really appreciating, yeah, just that reminder, and that it takes time. And talking of time, I'm aware that time we all miss out, which is frustrating because I have like 50 more questions I want to ask and ways this conversation could go. And like, yeah. And I really just appreciate everything you've brought today, and yeah, your honesty and kindness.
Working on it.
Exactly. And that, yeah, that we're all working on it, and that, yeah, you know, it does get easier the more we work on it. The like you say, we start seeing that in others, and once we get a taste of it, then it becomes that, yeah, that it becomes something that we want more of, and that feels more right. And I really, that was the other thing I want to say, was how much I appreciate you saying that it is a case-by-case situation. There's not a magic template, you know. Sometimes you walk away, sometimes you go towards, sometimes one of the things I had to do with one of my friends at one point is just put a pause on our friendship for like a few months, and now we're back in touch, and it's great. And when we met back, we had what we call a clearing, where we, you know, addressed any unspoken tension between us and understood why that pause needed to happen. And it came from a place of love. We were both in our own journeys, working on separate things that were activating each other. And so that pause needed to happen so that we wouldn't have a big rupture, you know? And now we're closer than ever, and it's wonderful. And then other times you need to go closer to someone. Sometimes what you need, if you're being kind and honest with yourself, is to reach out and get support from people. It's learning to accept help when it's offered at times, and other times it's setting a boundary and saying, actually, what I need right now is to be on my own. And so I could talk for hours. I think we could both talk for hours. But, if people want to know more about the topic, I really recommend they check out your zine, which is on your website. The zine is called Relationship Struggles, a trauma-sensitive relationship diversity affirmative zine. It's great.
Thank you.
And how can people find out more about you and your work and your website and all of that?
Yeah, well, rewritingrules.com, it's got all my published books, links to that, but I've also put out free books, which are kind of collections of all the blog posts and essays I've written, and one of those is on relationships, so it's got a lot about relationships. There's also one on consent, one on trauma, and one on plurality, and then there's a number of zines, which are basically what I'm making out of this journey of my own at the moment, of the things that are helping me. So again, if you know, it's not going to work for everyone, my approach either, but hopefully there's some stuff there that might be of use. It's all there. And Alex and I, as I said, are hoping to write a whole book on relationship trauma.
And I can't wait to read it. So that's Alex Ian Taffy for people.
Yes, and do check out that.
Well, yes, and their website, I think, is alexiantaffy.com. So people can check that out as well. They were meant to join us today, but sadly couldn't make it. But they're another fantastic author and educator on these topics. And
everything that is influenced by them, like, yeah, all the good bits. You know, if I said anything wrong, that wasn't theirs. But the other stuff is definitely very, like, you know, all these conversations, you know, again, it's that beautiful ripple effect of all these conversations we have with all of these, you know, folk who influence us, and then we can share those on. So,
amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so, so much for your time today. I really,
you're
really
welcome.